It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Open Concessions podcast presented by Toyota, featuring a weekly in-depth conversation with a Chicago Cubs-related personality. We are your hosts. I'm Len Casper, along with Jim DeShays. You may know us as the Cubs television tandem. JD, how's the final week of the regular season going?
Well, it's going great. Cubs got a win in Pittsburgh last night. It's the official first day of fall, although we're enjoying some summer-like weather. Looking forward to the postseason. Obviously disappointed that the regular season is coming to an end, but hopefully the Cubs have a good long run in the postseason.
Yeah, it's gone fast. We talked on the air the other night about you kind of felt when the season started, and I agreed that it was about a 50-50 chance we would actually finish the season, but you have to give baseball a lot of credit for the way they've handled, you know, the breakouts with several teams, including the Cardinals, who are going to get to the end of the season with a full slate.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you think about it, especially because, you know, the Marlins and the Phillies and the Cardinals and some of those early breakouts, the feeling was that this was just going to be unable to contain it, that it would just bounce around from one team to the next, and sooner or later they would have to shut it down. But obviously, industry-wide, players took it seriously. Everybody around the game took it seriously. And we've been able to push through without too many infections.
This week's guests, when we'll dive into some of this content as well, with Jason Stark and Doug Glanville. They host the popular Starkville podcast for The Athletic. We, in fact, were on that podcast earlier this summer. Jason writes for The Athletic, appears on MLB Network, and received the highest honor a baseball writer can get. He was named the J.G. Taylor Spink Award winner in 2019 in Cooperstown. Doug is a Marquee Sports Network colleague of ours, a University of Penn alum, had a nice 9-year major league career as an outfielder, including 2 stints as a Chicago Cub, a terrific writer as well, and is published by the New York Times, and one of the smartest people we've ever met.
Yeah, two really smart guys, 2 great baseball minds, and 2 guys that like to have a lot of fun, too. And a real good feel for the game. So my suggestion is we just let them run the podcast, and we'll just sit back and listen.
I love it. Here we go. Enjoy our conversation with Jason Stark and Doug Glanville. Doug and Jason, let's just get your general thoughts on the 2020 Major League season. You can go in any direction you want. Doug, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to look at it through a lot of lenses. Just you know, as a player, I kind of imagine what it would be like to go through this experience. And some of it is the great opportunity, as we saw that baseball was trying to take on a health crisis and not only provide, you know, entertainment, a respite, but also just the chance to learn from how we can combat what we're facing as a country, as a world. So I thought that was powerful, but, you know, I also see the sport change right in front of my eyes. It's the fastest you've seen baseball adapt to new rules, you know, whether it's 7 inning doubleheaders or ghost runners teleporting out of the sky into second base, or, you know, I mean, it's, and you kind of roll with it. You're like, okay, well, you know, we have to do some of these things. And so I'm excited to think about what the postseason is going to look at. You might have like 8 teams eliminated in one day or something. You know, it's going to just be bananas. So I've learned to take it as it comes, you know, and we've I found the quirkiness that, you know, Jason and I love about the game just has come out in 20-fold, just because everything we seem to see on a daily basis is not only new and unique, but like unprecedented. So we're also having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I'm the guy whose niche in life somehow became that crazy writer who compiles all the weird and wacky stuff. So, it, like, for what I do, the fact that it's the strangest season ever, yeah, I'm good with that. You know, like, I've had stuff happen this year. It's just amazing. One day on a Sunday morning, I get a text from Joey Wendell from the Rays, and he said, "I think I might have made history last night." Really? What happened? He said, "Yeah, I was the third batter due up in the top of the 11th inning, but I never batted." Because they had a two up, three down inning because of a double play. Like, this is the stuff that happens every day in a season like this. And I mean, like, I know it's driving some people insane, but I am just mesmerized by all of the crazy stuff that happens every day. It's keeping me in business. Nothing wrong with that.
What's the title of the book going to be, Jason?
Everybody asks me. Everybody thinks I have to write the Strange But True book. You know, my mom once told me I should write a book and call it "I Never Saw That Before."
Yeah,
I never wrote the book, but I am writing it basically every time I type. Maybe this is the year.
This is the year. It's got to be the year. 2020.
Well, we had a no-hitter in Milwaukee recently, and I asked the question because it was a 12-0 final. Orlando Arcia pitched the top of the ninth. So, Jason, has a position player ever pitched at a no-hitter?
Yeah. My friend Doug Kern actually tried looking that up. And, like, even – like, once you get back into, like, the 50s, the 40s, the 30s. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes between what's a position player and what's not, because, you know, you'd have these guys, they'd been an outfielder, and then all of a sudden they pitched 23 times. Okay. And that's what he found. He found a guy like that back in like 1912, and it looked like they were converting him to a pitcher. So we didn't, like, there was no way to conclusively answer that question. So that was what I just had to let go. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I get it. The runner at second and extras, just for the panel, JD can chime in. I was expecting to absolutely hate it and roll my eyes. And the first time we had it, I kind of loved it. I don't know if I want it permanently, but I'm intrigued. Anyone want to jump in?
I mean, I'm on record. I'm a fan of it. It took me like a week to write that. I talked to some people who managed in the minor leagues using that rule, and they loved managing with this rule. Morgan Ensberg used an expression I'd never heard, but it really sums it up well. He said, "It's half court baseball and it's awesome." And what he means by that is it's instant strategic decision-making. There's a lot of stuff going on. The second extra innings begins, right? You've got to decide, how do you want to approach this? And there are a million ways you can. We've seen them all. And I like it. Somebody made the point to me that until this, baseball had the least interesting overtime of any of the major sports. And when you add this ingredient, that's not true anymore. Now, I don't want to go to the postseason and do it this way. But with regular season, I actually think it's fun. What about you guys?
I'm kind of a... I like it as well, and I could. It would be curious to see if we stick with it and during the regular season going forward. If then at some point in the future it becomes part of postseason baseball, I think to do it right away would be a shock to the system. But this is one of those questions that we've had fun with. If you were a commissioner for a day, and everybody comes up with different variations on this rule. Some people say, "Well, play the first couple of innings straight, and then if nothing happens, start with a man on second base." I get that. The one that I kind of picked up, Len and I were talking the other night, you know, I like the concept of just kind of starting in that situation, man on second base. If you score two runs, game over, you win. The other side does not get a chance to hit. If you fail to score, game over, you lose. If you score the one run, the other team gets their opportunity. So kind of like the college football thing or the playoff football thing. Or I guess in the NFL, that's the two, right? In overtime, NFL. Where if you kick a field goal, the other team gets the ball. But if you score a touchdown, game over. And I don't know that it's better, but it's different. So I'm just embracing different.
Yeah. So if you did a basketball overtime that way, if a team came down and hit a three, game over?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. How about sudden death and
food? Sudden death yeah. basketball, wow.
Right. Imagine what those lineups would look like to start overtime.
How many fouls would there be to prevent a guy from shooting a three? Dudes would be just getting tackled in the open court.
Oh, yeah. Or they'd clone Steph Curry. They'd be like, all right, we got five Steph Currys now. And, cloning would be a big part of it. I think I say I understand it. I do understand it. And I haven't quite gotten to this point of like, yeah, this is awesome. Look, I get the issue with, all right, the entertainment side, right? It's going on, you're 17 innings in. And certainly in the regular season, if it's game like 112 in July and your team is 30 games out. I mean, I do understand that they wanted to come up with something that just created something finite and that still gives you a chance back and forth. So I also think that there is a reality that bullpens have changed the game so consequentially in recent times with analytics that we've kind of given up on the idea that, there's nobody's really going to go 8 and 9 innings. So we already are recognizing that extra innings is a period where you're running out of pitchers, which is very different than when like John Tudor pitched against Steve Carlton or whatever, and you went into extra innings that way. And so to some ways it's acknowledging defeat on, all right, well, the starters are just going to go 5 innings and that's a victory. So we have to kind of look at this as being afraid to run out of pitchers, right? So that's one thing I struggle with. And I think there's also the storytelling problem I have. I kept score. I was big on keeping score and scorecards. And because it's so hard to explain how this guy got there without using one of the volumes of Harry Potter, I think it just makes it, it's tough for me to say, like, how did he get there? So I don't know, with the playoffs, you want to come back to Game 7 and some guy won, a team wins the championship, wins the World Series on a ghost runner, who you can't explain how got there other than sort of arbitrary rules, right? So I'm willing to work with it. I'm definitely, but my scorecard is a mess with between shifting defenses and like base angels. It's getting really complicated.
Here's the one thing I do want to say, though. It is a weird rule. It would be totally bizarre for a World Series to end in a situation like this. But Jason, I bring up this all the time and people's heads explode. Bases loaded, one out, bottom of the 15th, Game 7 World Series, foul pop up, first baseman goes over, makes a catch, falls into the dugout. And the game ends, because if you fall out of play, everybody advances a base, right? Yeah. That rule is weird too. And that rule's been in the book forever. So you and I could come up with a million scenarios under the current baseball rules that have been in place for 100 years that could end a World Series, right? The hit by pitch with the bases loaded. Does that feel right to end a World Series? So we right. already do kind of have these strange scenarios that would feel empty if Game 7 of the final series of the season ended that way.
Well, I want to remind you that the World Cup is decided very often on penalty kicks.
Yes,
right. They gather these teams from all over the world. They play for a month and then they decide it on penalty kicks.
Right.
So tell me this isn't more like real baseball than that.
Well, I think the challenge I have with it is, I think I come back to, you can't explain how the guy got there through baseball. Right. That's right. My problem. Like, yeah. Okay, penalty kicks, but you don't, there's not a guy who parachutes in penalty kick time out of the sky and then says, oh, we got Giorgio Canalia now and he's going to, or Pele is now going to kick, like, I think that's where I have trouble. Like, I think they could spice it up and maybe require the ghost runner to wear a cape and have a grand entrance. I think I would go for that. That would be exciting. So we're going to have to spice it up a little bit.
Yeah. The NHL takes players off the ice, right? In overtime.
Right. Pull goalies and stuff.
Yeah, that was my suggestion too. You take each extra inning, you pull a guy off the field.
There you go. Exactly. You guys want to hear my favorite extra inning of the whole year?
Yeah.
This was the Yankees-Mets game a few weeks ago where, the Yankees are at Citi Field. The Yankees, top of the 10th, goes line drive, double play, strikeout. So that was the two up, three down inning. Now the bottom of the inning, Pete Alonso steps up and hits a walk-off two-run leadoff. So we just had the top and the bottom of an extra inning played with a total of three guys batting.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, that one almost feels like you could retroactively go, you know what? It's just a solo homer, right? Because you're giving a guy an RBI that he really didn't deserve.
Right. He went through his whole rookie year, hit 53 homers, and hit no walk-off homers. This was the first walk-off homer of his career. It was a leadoff two-run extra inning walk-off homer. What?
Oh, my gosh. It's crazy. The three-batter minimum, I like it, and I think it's here to stay. But I do think in this bizarre season, we haven't seen the true effects of it. I think we've had a lot of bullpen because of expanded rosters. We're going to have to limit pitchers again, which was the goal originally, right? It was going to be 13 max. Do we need to go down to 12 or 11? JD, I'll let you start.
I would be in favor of 9. obviously, we'll never go back there. But if you go back to the 70s and 80s, it was fairly common for pitching staffs to be, 9 or 10 guys. We're not going back there, obviously. But, I think it's a better game with fewer options for managers when they go to their bullpen. I don't want to cost anybody their job, but I think it's a cleaner game and there's fewer pitching changes, and I think it gives the hitters a fighting chance. There's so much velocity in the game now, and we see so many games in the later innings where the ball's just not being put in play. You talk about they talk about baseball having the least interesting overtime. Look at most games, late in games, most sports late when it's close is when the tension is high and there's a lot of drama and you're on the edge of the seat. Too many times in baseball now, it's strikeout, strikeout, walk, pop up, strikeout, 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 walk. And you're like, come on, let's, can we put the ball in play? Well, everybody coming out of the bullpen is throwing 98 miles an hour. So it's kind of counterintuitive for me to say this, but I pity the hitters. In the modern game. So I think limiting the pitching is a great idea.
Yeah. And you've really hit on the part of this that people almost never talk about. And that is you're giving your hitters a chance in the late innings. Just pick out your favorite left-handed middle of the order bat, Bryce Harper, Anthony Rizzo, pick whoever you want. Okay. And think about what their life used to be like before this rule. Once they got to the sixth inning, they were every at bat the rest of the game was going to be against some funky left-hander, right? Or the closer, or they might slip in a guy throwing 101 in there. Okay. And this at least means the manager has to make a decision. All right, you can bring that left-hander in to face Harper or Rizzo or whoever you're going to pick. But if you do, and you've got JT Realmuto on deck or Javi Baez on deck, then that left-hander's got to face that guy. And so you're giving your stars a chance in the late innings of games with games on the line. It's a huge factor.
Yeah, and I think it's like you're trying to, to JD's point, it's almost like you're looking for more diversification in your outcomes, right? It just seems like a disservice to the game where you're getting so narrow that you're like, okay, walk, strikeout, home run, walk, strikeout, home run, walk, strikeout, home run, whatever it is. And you're not really showcasing a lot of the athleticism. And, I saw a hit and run in the Angels game the other day. I was like, fell out of my chair. It was executed perfectly, just to see people in motion, and with the shifts and all these things, there's just limited opportunity to get on base already, let alone the fact that, you know, there's a lot of selling out, not only the velocity, but there's a selling out with two strikes. It's like, hey, well, I see two strikes now as an opportunity to hit a home run. It's just one more chance to hit a home run, as opposed to like, let me protect against it or choke up. So, you know, when you do that, you have so much more emphasis on this small sample size of outcomes. And you're just losing a lot of like what other players are capable of. And I think the same holds true for pitching. It's like, I don't know, I want to see Kyle Hendricks pitch past the second time around, because he might find something in the tank. He might be able to do something that he's done, you know, that actually inspires us all, because it was the minority report, yet it still came out. And that's what we remember. We remember Tom Lawless hitting a home run, right, in the World Series or whatever. You know, like, it wasn't supposed to happen. It was a low percentage outcome, but it happened. And that's something that sticks with you.
Well, the irony of all of this, and you know, batting averages keep going down, but I think one of the big culprits is that all of the new parks in the last 20 years have moved their fences in. So this is weird paradox that it's easier to hit a home run at Citi Field and Comerica Park in Seattle than it was when those parks opened. And there was just this outrage when they opened at Petco Park. Remember Klesko and Nevin?
Oh, yeah,
I mean, they wanted to blow up the stadium because, you know, you never got rewarded if you hit a ball well to right. Well, I don't mean to speak for Jim Deshays, but like, too bad, right? Like, I just think that because these parks are so reachable now, that we've created this monster of everything, every guy in every lineup can hit a home run. Doug, you played in some big ballparks in the late 90s that, you know, Miami, that place, nobody hit a home run to right if you were right-handed. Well, you didn't even try.
Well, what excites me about what you're saying, Len, is that you named like four of those stadiums I hit home runs in before they moved defensively. So
I'm feeling
very strong right now. But yeah, they were just graveyards. And look, I mean, the Coors Field, for example, to me was the worst nightmare of all, because not only is it, you hit it in the air, it's gone, but you hit it in the gap, you can't catch it. I mean, I remember standing in center field at Coors Field and being like, I can't even think of covering all this ground. Like, the gaps are humongous. You could fit Fenway inside of it. And the grass was so short. So there was this play to offense. And like you said, you know, Len, it was like, you kind of created your own monster now, right? You fell to the pressures to bring the fences in. It's created intimacy on one level, and it's just created, you know, opportunity to just go deep at any given time.
I don't think this has been tried before, but Jason, you're plugged in. Why don't you run this by the commissioner and all the other lords of the realm who make decisions about baseball? Why don't we build new stadiums that are huge and symmetrical, and put artificial surface on the ground so that the ball in play really scoots through the infield, and we try not to hit home runs? That might be a novel approach.
It sounds like cricket, actually. It's like it rolls out.
Do those parks now qualify as retro parks?
That's right. Bring back the cookie cutters are now retro. And we want AstroTurf, and we want Whitey Herzog ball.
Well, we do need more great athletes running around those bases. I think that's what Len was getting at.
Yeah.
I think somewhere back there was the point that what would make baseball a more interesting game now is fewer balls flying over the fence and more balls that don't quite make it over the fence, which allows world-class athletes to collect web gems at greater frequency than we're getting to see them now, and more great athletes running around the bases. Like, those things would be cool. Is the solution move back the fences? Is the solution deaden the ball or normalize the ball? Somewhere in there, I think this is stuff baseball's going to have to look at.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think of like double plays. Like, you know, I know, like, this is one of those examples. Like, I appreciate the rule for safety that you can't take out the middle infielder anymore. You can't run over the catcher. Of course, that's important. And that is how you need to evolve for safety purposes. But you do lose something, right? Ozzie Smith, first of all, you couldn't get him anyway. You know, Mark Lemke, you know, guys I try to take out that knew how to get out of the way. It was just cool, even as an opponent, to see their acrobatics, just to see their ability to get out of the way. And so, yes, you have to change certain things. And sometimes it's for entertainment value and the business of baseball. But we also have to just be mindful of what we're taking away and what we're losing. And that sometimes helps us think about what we might want to get back to, maybe in a different form.
Well, that's a great point. That's a really, really good point. We have lost a little artistry in the middle of the diamond. And, you know, because a guy's spike is not just barely touching the bag, right? The neighborhood play existed forever and everybody seemed cool with it. Today's the day to get 0% APR financing for 60 months on a new 2020 RAV4. Head into your local Toyota dealer today or visit toyota.com for more details. Event ends September 30th. The other thing that we're missing now, and this is a tough subject because we lost a really good friend last week, Gary Hughes, one of the greatest scouts of all time and one of the nicest human beings of all time. And the thing I miss, I think, the most about being at the ballpark in a normal environment is being around the people, being around you guys and talking to scouts. And a lot of scouts are losing their jobs. And I worry a lot about that we've taken too much of the human element out of the game. So Jason and Doug, I'll let you guys take that wherever you want. And if you have a good Gary Hughes story, I'd love to hear it. I've got a million of them, but I'd love to hear what you guys have to say.
Well, first off, I really share the sentiment. You know, I'm somebody, anytime I go to a park, walk into a press room, I could hang out with my writer friends anytime, but like I'm always looking around for the scouts in the room. Who can I have dinner with and learn something, you know? And that's already, even before the pandemic, becoming more challenging as more and more great scouts lose their jobs. And that whole aspect of this, that whole trend saddens me. And I think this fall is going to be the worst carnage in the scouting industry that we've ever seen. And I'm already holding my breath, feeling for all my scout friends who are going to lose their jobs. It's going to happen. And Gary Hughes kind of is the ultimate example of why we need these people in the game. Anytime Gary Hughes walked into any ballpark, everybody in the park was happy to see him. Every single person, myself included. And it was an opportunity to sit down with a guy who loved being at that park, who you felt connected to within the first 5 seconds of speaking with him because he just was so warm and welcoming. And you would laugh, you would learn something, and you'd go away feeling good about being there. I don't have one Gary Hughes story, except for this. The day I got laid off by ESPN a couple of years ago, I was in San Francisco. I was getting ready to go to AT&T Park. And so I didn't go that day, but I decided to go the next day. And I walked into the press box, and the first person I saw was Gary Hughes. And I kept thinking, how am I going to explain this to people? How am I going to talk to people about it? And Gary made me feel so much better because that was a gift that he had. How many times did Gary Hughes change jobs? You know, and every time he came up smiling and he let me know that. And he made me think, I can do that. And I'll forever be grateful to him just for that day and that moment in time when we met in that ballpark.
Hmm. You know, I think of scouts as stewards of the game. I think of them as timekeepers. And I think that is such a tremendous loss when you lose the priorities around preserving what they represent in the game. And you can't, you know, you can't analytically replace them from that importance culturally of what they mean, not just to, you know, evaluating talent, but you build relationships with scouts. I mean, I could tell so many stories of scouts, you know, trying to, you know, calling and talking me through, you know, all the things around the draft. And even after the draft, Billy Blitzer was my sort of regional scout when I was drafted by the Cubs in 91. And it was also a learning experience. I mean, there was times with scouts that I had frustration because I was getting evaluated and I didn't necessarily agree with the evaluation, or they were determining, you know, how much I should get signed for or what slot to be in. But I also learned a whole lot about the game. My brother used to go on tryouts by the Scouting Bureau. Remember the Scouting Bureau back in the day?
Oh, sure.
And they would send out these calendars, you know, sometimes Baseball Digest or whatever, and you get this list of like, oh, here are all the tryouts on the East Coast. And I remember going to a Mets tryout, sneaking into Shea Stadium, basically. I was underage. My brother lied about my age, and I ended up pitching in Shea Stadium bullpen, and the scouts were there. And they kept, you know, it's just so, you know, that it's a smaller part of this picture of where analytics, which has always been a driver in baseball, where you want to try to manage the change in technology and how you implement for your cultural preservation, right? And this is what we're talking about, right? We 7-inning doubleheaders and all these things. There's a cultural component of baseball that we want to make sure we still maintain what makes it so special and so unique. We're not basketball. We're not football. It's not a sport that is measured by clocks and times and speed. It's something else. And that something else is captured in scouting. It's captured in storytellers and writers and what is the slow work of our society. And so I do hope that we don't drown out this sort of hands-on, tangible way that we evaluate people. I understand we have data. I understand that you can measure certain things. I get it. But there are some things that you cannot measure. And if you trade those in, you'd lose part of the soul of the game. And so, you know, Gary, I came across, you know, different times. In fact, I just see him in different uniforms, I guess, because he was in Cincinnati and he was wherever, you know. And I don't, you know, have like any standout story, but just thinking of him amongst others as making me feel like there's protectors of the game, because they care enough to be, first of all, traveling the country, seeing those stories, connecting the dots, and evaluating talent and seeing where the talent in the future lies. And they have, in that, they wield great power and great responsibility. And I think they'd be sorely missed if the profession was erased.
Yeah. Well said. JD, you have a lot of former teammates who are scouts. And the other kind of, it's you laugh and you cry, but we see guys every year and we almost ask them, so who are you with this year? Because they do bounce around so much. And like, if you see a guy with the Diamondbacks one year and you're like, hey, how's your club? And you're like, oh, you're with the Twins?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Yeah. It's like they should wear, you know, identifying logoed merchandise, you know, so we know, oh, okay, that's you. Yeah. Yeah. And the same way, I don't have a great Gary Hughes story, but, you know, my heart goes out to all the guys in the industry that are already out of jobs or will likely be out of jobs soon. Pete Vukovic telling a joke in a press room. I mean, every time you see Vuk, right, the first thing out of his mouth, hey, did you hear the one about ...
Right.
And then the other one, you can't sit down at a table with scouts without stumbling into the room rate conversation. Where you're saying, what's your rate, right? I mean, I've never been in a conversation with scouts where they haven't talked about what the rate is that they're getting. And then you slowly morph into a, you know, baseball conversation. And guys are all over the map. There are some old school guys that have, you know, had to be dragged kicking into the data revolution. And there are other guys that completely embrace it, or at least somewhat embrace it. And it's kind of ironic that with all the data that's available now, that the new competitive edge, when we get back to some sense of normalcy, might be boots on the ground scouting, because there's going to be a lot of people that have cut their scouting staffs. And my hope is that you know, teams will realize a year or two from now, like, you know what, we need to beef back up because there's an advantage to be had by having guys out advancing other clubs, and not to mention all the guys that are out doing free agent scouting and amateur scouting. And you talk about the lifeblood, you know, I remember when I was in high school in Northern New York and it's, you know, 28 degrees and snowing, and there's old Dutch Dotterer with the fedora on and the long wool coat right out of central casting, you know, with his radar gun and, you know, scribbling notes. I mean, those guys are precious.
Yeah, they are. Two quick things. One on Gary. The one thing I really appreciated about him was that he said, look, I don't know a lot of the new analytics and a lot of the ways teams are evaluating players because I come from a different kind of mindset. But he said, I want to learn. And I always appreciated that about him because, as you guys know, there are a lot of old school scouts who scoff at it, and understandably so, because they felt like they were being replaced by it. But I always felt that Gary kept a very open mind, and really until the very end, he just wanted to learn as much as he possibly could. So I appreciated that very much. And the other one escapes me, but I know what I was going to say. And this is more for Jason, I guess, as a journalist who covers the game, is that you get the best stories from scouts because they've seen these players when they were kids and we didn't. And I'm sure you've gotten some of your best stories from scouts to find out about the star player and all the little nuggets and the little bits of information from when that kid was 17 that you didn't know, right?
So, I mean, I can't think of one that comes to mind off the top of my head, but absolutely. Every time you're writing a profile about this some young player who just blew into the big leagues, you're going to find that scout who signed him. You know, if you're going to write that first Mike Trout story of your career, you're mm-hmm. going to track down Eddie Bain, who's going to tell you about how few people were at the first game he ever watched Mike Trout play in Millville and something that happened. Hey, actually, we told one.
Wait, didn't you have Kiermaier?
Kiermaier story. Yeah. This is actually a great story. We had Kevin Kiermaier on Starkville a week ago. And I talked to the scout who signed him. Now, Kevin Kiermaier was not a big prospect. So he was playing at some little junior college. And this scout had been following him for years, had been talking him up. And they said, okay, well, we need what time do you have on him going down the line? And he realized he had never timed him. So he goes to this game and Kevin Kiermaier walks the first time up and then the second time up and then the third time up. And so the scout actually had to go down on the field and whisper to Kevin, I need a time for you going to first base. And so he walks the fourth time up and sprints down the line to get to first. Like, if we're going to lose those scouts, we're going to lose this whole lore, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's great.
That is great. And it just kind of also reminded me of a couple of recent stories of guys whose high school coaches didn't really think they were going to materialize into anything, and they became big leaguers. This is for Doug and JD. The chip on the shoulder thing that players seem to have, and I think it's fairly universal, even guys who don't admit it. How big a driver is that for guys, even if it doesn't really exist? You know, this guy didn't believe in me, and so I'm going to prove him wrong. Doug, did you have that? You know, you mentioned there were some scouts who evaluated you in a way you didn't agree with.
Yeah, I mean, it was important to me. I can't say it's a sole motivator. I loved baseball from birth. I mean, my brother had me out there as soon as I could walk, and so there was also this aspect of, you know, I want to do this. I want to play as long as I can, and I just love to be part of it. And along the way, you do have detractors, and you do have people that aren't fair to you, or maybe you don't have the perspective at the moment that might have been right about you, and you just needed to mature in certain ways. And I certainly had many of those. And you know, and I think of you know, I was on this show called Mojo Mondays. It was a podcast recently talking about coaches along the way. And as you mentioned with the scouts, I remember Peter Gammons, and I love Peter, kind of gave me a little jab in the Boston Globe about when I was about to get drafted in the first round, saying that, I was a good prospect, but some people wonder whether he wants to play. And his point was that I was at an Ivy League school. I could have played at a bigger program. And I was focusing on, I missed doing all these, special baseball academies and stuff to study and make sure that I, graduated. So I had, and in fact, I missed the game to study for a final my junior year, things like that. So I took a lot of heat for those things. And that was one of the things. And I remember being so hurt, like, this guy doesn't even know me. He's never met me before. But of course I came to love Peter Gammons, but it was sort of the scouts had that role, right? They had to be unbiased in their way, even though there was bias, but they had to find ways to, and sometimes they might talk to you on the side and motivate you with it. And you're just taking it, as a 20-year-old, in my case, kind of hard. I had a guy tell me in an interview with the New York Times, a writer tell me that he got wind for something that happened when I was 14 years old. That one of my teammates said that I only showed up when I wanted to show up at a game, actually show up physically. And he used that for a column he was writing about me 6 years later when I was about to get drafted, right? So those were tough. But as to your point, yeah, I use it as motivation. In fact, the Detroit Tigers came to a game that summer when I was 20, about to get drafted. And this is not my style, but this is how tired I was. I was getting a lot of heat about choosing an Ivy League school and maybe he doesn't want to play and that kind of thing. And so the scout came to a game, summer league game, Woodbat League, catches me in the parking lot and he starts going off on all these things I had been hearing. Well, you're a great talent, but some wonder whether you want to play, blah, blah, blah. And he was just regurgitating this. So I got mad and I said, I told him, I said, look, first of all, you know what? I explained my parents' story. My dad, an immigrant from Trinidad, paid all this money to go to University of Pennsylvania. I need to graduate. I'm going to graduate. And I can play in between, but this is what I'm going to do. And I had to kind of say that. And then I slipped in, by the way, when are you selecting? When's your first pick? And they said 40-something. I was like, well, I won't be around long enough for you anyway. So that's definitely, but I know basically, yes, along the way, there was detractors. My AAA manager in Iowa for the Cubs was a complete nightmare to me. He kicked me not only out of the game one time, but kicked me out of the stadium. So I could tell that story another time. But but in the end, I realized that I had to thank later my detractors as well as my supporters. And I think that did create a chip at different times. And that motivation was, as important as really the desire to be great or desire to win.
JD, you've told the Billy Martin story and you laugh at it, but there had to be part of you when you had success in Houston. They're like, yeah, take that, Billy. You didn't know who I was 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, it never really motivated me, but you took a certain amount of pleasure in proving people wrong. I was a 21st round draft pick out of Lemoyne College, so I doubt that anybody had high expectations for me. And I was actually drafted in the 13th round out of high school. So I was going backwards. I said, I better sign or this, what was the old story? I think it was Kuzman that used to tell it. It was Euchre. It was Euchre's story about, he's the one that gave the club the signing bonus just so he could go play. So I was kind of in that position coming out of college, 21st rounder as a senior. So I had no leverage. And I do like to go back and I'll look at, Baseball Reference and I'll look at all the other players drafted ahead of me that never made it to the big leagues. Take that. that may be petty, but so be it. And the other one that the little chip I did carry when I was with the Yankees, my first start was part of a doubleheader against the White Sox. And I want to say, I think it was Mike McAlary. I was writing in the Daily News or Jason, you would probably know better than me.
Sure.
Who went. Okay. And then he then moved to crime and news. But anyway, one of the quotes after the game, and it didn't go all that well for me, he said, White Sox batters were literally seen sprinting to the batter's box to get a shot at Bichette's. And so I did clip that out, and I carried that in my wallet for a little while. And then the other one, when I first got traded to Houston for Joe Niekro, who was wildly popular down there and tremendously successful, there was a column in the Houston Post that greeted me when I landed in Houston. It was in the backseat of the cab. And the lead paragraph said, "The Astros traded their heart and soul today, and in return got a couple of chest hairs and a couple of fingernails." that was my welcome to Houston moment.
Oh. Wow.
Oh, wow.
Hey, wow. I have a prediction that you should watch for coming up in like a week. That is, we're going to set an all-time postseason record for most times we hear, "Nobody thought we'd be here but us." Okay, yeah. Right? Yeah. When the Marlins and the Padres and the White Sox and the Blue Jays, if they win a game, we're going to hear it.
Yeah.
Right?
Hey, yeah. You'll even hear it from the Dodgers. Dodgers win the whole thing. We were up against it, the adversity. Nobody thought we could do this because we haven't done it the last 8 years. Every team feels compelled to make that case.
Well, play that card.
One of the other lessons, Jason, is that when writers and talk show hosts and broadcasters like me get confronted by a player for something we said or wrote, the player, it gets angry, and the answer is always, "It's not personal." And I tell everybody, you have the right to do all this. I'm not telling anyone they can't write these pithy lines about Jim Deshaies when he gets traded to the Astros, but it's always personal. A Major League Baseball player, when he's playing, during his career, every fiber of his body is defined by being a big league player. So any slight, and this is what we're kind of getting at here, it's always personal. So whenever I've had very few of these situations, I always go in with that understanding. And I never say, "It's not personal. I'm not talking about you as a person," and I'm sure you've had those moments too, Jason. Like, you got to let, sometimes you got to let guys wear you out. And then by the end of it, you come to an understanding, you explain why you wrote what you wrote or said what you said, and then you move on. But it's always personal.
Yeah. I get along with people. I don't have a lot of these, but do they happen? Yeah, they happen. Sometimes they get pretty heated and you just got to rope-a-dope and get through it. But, I had a long time where I used to do a weekly thing called the Box Score Line of the Week. And it was never some guy who 9 innings, 1 hit, 15 strikeouts.
Right.
It was always 1 inning, 13 hits, 12 runs. Right? And those were the box score lines of the week because they were crazy. And I read one of the Dirk Hayhurst books. I don't know if you guys read those books, but
yeah, the Bullpen Gospels, I think.
The Bullpen Gospels, right. Yeah. And he described his big league debut. He had one of those outings. And this wave of depression that swept over him that he couldn't shake for weeks. And I thought, oh my God, like this is the personal side of box score lines of the week. And I honestly stopped doing them regularly at that point. Now, we had a guy give up 13 runs in relief a week ago. I wasn't going to ignore that one, but in general, I try to be really use as much discretion as I can now, just about something I used to think of as innocent like that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's Jason, go ahead, JD.
It's just funny how your self-worth as a player is so tied to the your performance. I remember the summer of my discontent in Minnesota when I was just horrible and sitting in the dugout in Anaheim, and Mark Langston, I think, was pitching for the Angels that night, and he was having a bad year. I don't think he had many, but it was probably towards the end of his run, and I was having a horrible year, and I was sitting in the dugout, I'm waiting to head out to the bullpen to warm up. And there was, a cop in the dugout because there's always security around. Still pretty early. And they had up on the big board, today's matchup, Mark Langston with his record in ERA and then my record in my ERA. And the cop, he had no idea who I was. And I was sitting right next to him, basically. And he looks up at the board. He's, "Oh, God, it's going to be a long one tonight." That was like the last thing I heard before I dropped my head and kind of walked slowly out to the bullpen. I was like Eeyore heading out to the bullpen.
Oh, man.
Well, JD just answered my question, Jason. I was going to ask you how it came to be that basically Jim Deshays was quoted in your weekly column every week in 1999.
How the heck
is it because
did
of the, stuff like this, right?
Yeah. Have you noticed that JD's amusing?
Like, yes,
when
I have.
When I walk into any clubhouse, my first question, if I don't already know the answer, is who's the funniest guy in the room? You know, and I think, Jim, you and I, we got connected by our mutual friend Jim Capel, right? And then the rest is history because you and our other mutual friend, one of our other mutual friends, Larry Anderson, were in a back and forth debate about who was the worst hitting pitcher in baseball, or who was the best worst hitting pitcher in baseball. And so, what was the year we actually did that? We staged World Series. Yeah. Was a team. This was, Len, I don't know if you remember this, but we did a team. We programmed a team. Tom Tango did it. 9 Larry Andersons played 9 Jim Deshazes, and we did a World Series.
Oh my goodness!
Did anybody score?
The who was the winner, Jim?
The Deshays. The Deshays club won.
The nice. Deshays team. The Deshays team won. So, this had to be 93 because the year you get traded to the Giants. Right, I was out. The Giants and the Braves were in this epic race. And so I was following the Giants around. And Jim Deshays gets traded to the Giants. He walks into the room. He sits down at his locker. He's there to save the day. He sits at his locker. He looks at this big throng of people, of writers surrounding him, sees me, and says, "Hey, what did I win?" This is for winning the Jim Deshays Larry Anderson World Series. And everybody's going, "What?" Only he and I knew what that was all about.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, that is great. Well, we have just a few more minutes with you guys. Doug, this is tough to answer, but what are you most proud of in terms of your affiliation with the game? And I say it that way because it doesn't have to be necessarily some baseball feat when you were a player. It could be a column you've written that you've gotten great response to. I think you could go in a lot of different directions here, but when you think about your stamp on baseball, and I know baseball has given a lot to you, but you've given a lot back to the game. What are you proudest of?
Yeah, Len. Well, I mean, you know, it's a good question. I think I always appreciated my relationships with my teammates and those around the game, whether press or front office. And that was important to me, and it was validating to me in a lot of ways. And, you know, whether it was players coming to me as a player rep about their rights, or whether it was telling stories about how consequential sports are in our society, and I teach a class on that, I always found ways that baseball was so much bigger and so much more important than what I did on the field or just the numbers. So I think keeping that legacy around the game has been some of the areas where I'm most proud or most, proud of not of what I've been able to do around preserving baseball in a light that sees it as part of the solution, as part of what brings us together and humanity. And telling those stories is part of it, writing about those stories. And, and I think, I had moments, for example, where my father passed away on the last game of the season in 2002. And it was that day I got my 1,000th hit of my career. And I didn't know he had passed away until after the game. And I needed 2 hits. Carl Pavano was pitching and ended up getting 3 hits and got 1,001 and buried him with that ball. And I think that, baseball has meant so many other things that you realize that you're representing so much more than yourself, communities, fandom, history, legacy, family, all these ways that it connects. And I always took that to heart every day. And so, I think it's, baseball, I always think of the legacy of baseball. And so that will be something I take with me. And I always try to fight to create those analogies and those metaphors of life for life to find ways to bring us together as people. And I think I've been something that I'm proud of is I feel like I've been fairly successful at that to raise these issues. And hopefully I'll continue to get that opportunity.
Very well said. Jason, I just remember seeing that you won the Spink Award last year and just how excited and so well-deserved that was.
Thank you.
That day had to be pretty special for you.
Yeah, I'll and, think about it once in a while.
Yeah. What do you think about in terms of what you've brought to the game? Because I just think about someone who loves the game as much as anybody, and you're always open to crazy ideas and funny stories, and I love that. You're never in a bad mood, and I think that resonates with everyone you've ever known.
Len, I appreciate that so much. I don't know where to start with that because there's so much in that question, but first off, I'm one of the lucky ones because I got to do exactly what I always dreamed of doing from the time I was old enough to dream about doing anything. Seriously, from the time I was 10 years old, I wanted to be a baseball writer. And it's just crazy that that happened. I mean, I told the story in my Hall of Fame speech, but on the wall of my office, there's a framed picture of me and my sister walking home from school. I was in fifth grade, she was in fourth grade. And underneath it is this composition that she wrote for her class in fourth grade. And it's about her brother, the baseball nut. And it actually says there, if you ever want to know anything about baseball, you should ask my brother. I was 10. And I look at it sometimes because it's right by the door of my office and think, wow, how the heck did this happen? How did I get to lead this life? And so I think it starts there. I'm living the dream, literally. I always felt like for some reason it was my mission to find the joy and the fun in the game. That's what brings us all to sports anyway, right? That's what we're looking for. We're looking to find joy and memories, and they're in there. And so I've always gravitated toward that side of baseball. I love talking about baseball with people who love it like I do, like you guys. I love talking baseball with people who make me laugh and smile, like you guys. And I love the just the craziness inside every day of the baseball season. And stuff happens. My phone starts buzzing. I know there's something just happened that people think is like a Jason Stark kind of game. And I really don't know how I became that guy, but I enjoy being that guy. And I take great joy in having somebody like you, Len, say, I know how much you love the game. People say that to me all the time. It's the greatest compliment you could pay me. I was talking a few weeks ago to, should I describe, a baseball official. And look, we just come through a tough time with the negotiations with the union, and a lot of it was contentious. And, you know, those of us who cover baseball, we had to write some stuff during that period that I was not very complimentary of the way that all went down. And yet this guy said to me, he said, I'm going to tell you something. When I read a story that you write, even when it's not necessarily a positive story about the way the sport is run or about something we did, I still come away knowing you love the game and how much you love the game. And that's not true of everybody. And so I just want you to know that I appreciate that that's the perspective which you write all of this. And like these are the things that people tell me that are just so rewarding that make me feel like, all right, they've, you know, somehow when I write these words, it captures who I am and how I feel about the sport I cover. Somehow that, you know, I wound up in Cooperstown giving that speech. Last winter, we went to Cooperstown just at a time when nobody was in town. It was January. We walked through the Hall of Fame. We saw like three people. And my wife and I, we stood there and we looked at that Spink exhibit, thinking, oh my God, you know, this actually happened. And I don't know what your, you know, what your concept of forever is, but the thought hit us, like people are going to walk through that Hall of Fame and walk through that portion of the Hall of Fame forever, and they're going to be forced to look at my name and my picture and my little bio there. And I can't comprehend people doing that in 100 years or 300 years or 1,000 years or whatever forever turns out to be. That is insane. But somehow, like, all this happened to me, and I'm in disbelief that it did, but so appreciative.
And JD, you know what they're going to say in 150 years when they look at that picture? What a head of hair.
Something they're not going to say about Jim Deshaies, right?
Awesome hair.
I'm at the point now where I see old pictures of JD with hair and I go, who are you? I don't recognize that guy anymore. You know, JD, I just had one last thought. I just had an idea. We should maybe do a podcast with these guys.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea at all.
Who would have thought of that? Hey, yeah. Jason, Doug, and JD, this was great. I really enjoyed the hour, and let's try to do it again, okay?
That'd be great. Yeah, we love you guys.
Hey, be safe, guys. Be well. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, you
and,
too.
And Len, check your cell. I texted you a box score.
Okay.
Yes, I did. And it's a NCAA box score, University of Pennsylvania versus Lemoyne College.
Ooh.
In Waterbury, Connecticut. And we set the record for biggest lean blown in tournament history.
Oh, that's right. So, you were on that team.
Yeah, John Ratliff.
He was a first-round pick of the Cubs.
18-16. Wow. 18-16. This is great. Yeah, May 27th, 1989.
Yeah, wow. We were in Pittsburgh playing the Pirates. And we were out like for BP, and I was with the Astros, and our media relations guy came out and said, you wouldn't believe what Lemoyne College is doing. And I, what are they doing? And they're coming back. Wow.
Doug Glanville went 3-for-7.
Wasn't
your
fault.
Two runs
Doug.
Scored. It was not your fault.
Yeah, couldn't do anything to stop it.
Well, yeah, thanks for that. That's great. Doug, thank you.
All righty.
Jason, care, always right. appreciate the time, fellas.
All right. Love you guys. You guys. Be well.
Yep.
Hey, JD, did you know fans can still sign up for the Cubs season ticket holder waitlist? Fans can secure their spot in line right now for the chance to purchase Cubs season tickets. Once you're signed up, the Cubs will send emails periodically to let you know your place in line. For information and to sign up, go to cubs.com/waitlist. Thanks to Jason and Doug for joining us this week. And as we have started to do, we are diving into the Dixon Baseball Dictionary and talking some baseball terminology. And JD, you get to pick the letter, and I'll pick a couple of entries.
All right. Let's go with the letter B. B for baseball.
B for baseball. Okay. That was pretty easy to find. All right. Let's go. here we go. Bat Night, a promotion at which fans are given souvenir bats at a night baseball game. Now, it doesn't have the story here, but was it Yankee Stadium? Where was the place where they gave out bats when the game, before the game started, and they realized that was a really bad idea?
Yeah. I think Yankee Stadium is right.
You should give bats out at the end of the game, if at all.
There was a bad call or something, and chaos ensued. And I think it happened at ball day too, right? Weren't people launching baseballs on the field at some point?
Exactly right.
Bad day, bat night, ball day, beer night, all those things have ended up with some level of chaos.
All right, how about a belly whopper? Any idea on what this is?
A belly whopper.
This is a Dizzy Dean phrase.
Oh, well, I'm guessing that it's when Dizzy was broadcasting, and it probably refers to a headfirst slide.
That's exactly right. It's characterized by a long airborne dive into the base. A belly whopper. I love it.
And Dizzy once said he used to use the word slud too. Like he slid into third.
All right, let's do a. Okay, last one. a bowel locker. This is
I'm taking a sip of tea as you said that. Sorry. It came out my right nostril.
That is a sharp breaking curveball. Bowel locker. This was phrased by Dick Cagle of the Seattle Times back in 1988.
Wow.
I really like that. Bowel
just
locker.
Kind of, just locks them up. Just
all right. Good stuff. Baseball terminology. All right. Any admissions this week?
Here's kind of a question as a part of our admission. When you're trying to parallel park and you're having a hard time getting into the spot, how many attempts do you make before you leave?
I would say I'm down to about two. I have very little patience.
I ran into that issue the other day, and I tried about three times, and I finally said, "Oh, the heck with it," and I pulled out. And I consider myself, you know, I wouldn't say I'm a great parallel parker. I would say I'm a middle of the rotation parallel parker, but some days it's just not there, and you've got to move on.
Yeah, I have one of those electric cars now, and I believe I have automatic parallel parking, but I'm still now.
You don't trust it yet, right?
Well, it's not that I don't trust it. I feel like I still should be able to do it. And that's kind of one activity or skill I would prefer not to just never do again.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of fun to parallel park and get it in one or two moves. So
the idea of putting my hand, interlocking my fingers behind my head while the car parks itself is really intriguing.
Okay.
That would be fun.
You should try it. Yeah, that's good stuff. On that note, we will talk to you next week. A special thanks to Max Berman, Joe Rios, Matt Romito, Daniel Green, Jim Obojkowicz, Shane McGuire, Adam Sobel. And for Jim Deshaies, I'm Len Casper. Make sure you subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast with your friends. This was Open Concessions, presented by Toyota.